Welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan, on this bleak and empty and haunted city. If you get newspapers, as I do, and read newspapers, you will be pretty well informed on what is going on in this world, in this country, in this city. You can also listen to this very station and be pretty well informed. One of the problems, I think, is to get too well informed, where all of the information starts to get redundant and starts to, as a result, be almost meaningless. So that's why this show, I'm not going to give you facts and figures. I'm going to try to give you a reprieve, a break from the sad news. Although my friend Rich Cohn on the phone from Connecticut, the story that I wrote about in Sunday's paper is hardly an upbeat tale. Rich, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. How are you coping with you and your wife are homebound with, and it boggles my mind, with four boys, ages 16, 14, 12, and four. How is that going?
It's like a social experiment gone horribly awry. I mean, it's going okay. We have a yard, thank God, and we are able to sort of walk around. But you know, it's strange because you don't know. There's like no end in sight. You don't know what's going to happen. So it's kind of the uncertainty of the whole thing, and just the only feeling about it is what's happening to us is happening to everyone in the country, and it's.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like I've always feel like a young person, but I'm 51. I'm not that young anymore. And I've never, you know, nothing like this has ever happened in my lifetime and the lifetime of my father, who was born in 1932,
Right. So, yeah, there's
just like the only preparation has been zombie movies that I've seen now and then. I always hated zombie movies.
Your piece, I wrote about you because you have been, over the last couple of months, been unveiling a compelling six-part series in a new publication. I want to talk a lot about this new publication because I think it is the new Vanity Fair. It's called Murder in Fairfield County. It's a tale of love, betrayal, adultery, big money, and eventually murder. Tell me again, and it's in, you can read this in my story too, ladies and gentlemen, but it's often good to hear from the author. You came upon this because you lived nearby to where this tragedy happened.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Glencoe, but I live in Fairfield County in a town called Ridgefield, which is, you know, a nice town, but New Canaan is like the fanciest town around here. So I live in a nice town, not quite as fancy as New Canaan, which is sort of a famous, rich American town. And this is the way I heard about the story was, this is somebody very much from my world and that lives nearby, kids my kid's age, she has five kids, and her kids go to this, you know, very nice private school called the New Canaan Country School. And this mother, who is in the middle of a bad divorce, drops her kids off at school and then just vanishes.
Vanishes.
No one ever sees her again, and they've never found her. And so I was following it like a, you know, confused, freak out, amazed parent, people trying to figure out what happened to this person. And it started out as a missing person story, but the more you knew about her marriage and her husband and then the incredible work of the Connecticut State Police and the New Canaan Police and the ability of surveillance slowly, you know, revealed what it seems like happened, which is that her husband concocted this whole plot to make her vanish.
Yeah, it is chilling on every level. And what is notable about it is your astonishing reporting. You do give a lot of credit to the what you call the fine local papers out there who did cover this. But you really, this kicked into a major story once you got a hold of the arrest warrant, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the way so much reporting is right now because of the internet, everything has be so fast.
Sure.
And like, you know, the police are putting out these 50-page arrest warrants packed with details and all kinds of social details too. I mean, not just fact stuff, but about who these people were, where they came from, what kind of clothes they were wearing. All these details would say something about who they were and the world they lived in that was just not picked up in the very good newspaper stories because the people didn't have time. They were all about the breaking news. And I felt that's what was being missed. That's what I can write about. And then also culturally, you know, where this town is, what this place is, who these people were, and try to figure out what it all means.
Well, that's where you write. You write in your story. You write when you leave New York City for Fairfield County, you enter America as you imagined it used to be, a Martha Stewart land of rolling hills, green valleys, and blue forest. It is peppered with towns that, quote, stand for a certain American social context. Old money, horses, and blue blood snobbery. Some of that, I mean, you can relate to growing up on the North Shore, though this place seems even more rarefied than Glencoe, Kenilworth, and some of those suburbs, doesn't it? It is, isn't it?
Yeah, well, what surprised me when I first moved here, and I've been living here for about 10 years, is how old it is.
Yeah.
So Glencoe is pretty old. I mean, Glencoe, I have a map from before the Civil War, and Glencoe appears on that map. So Glencoe was founded right about then. It was called Taylorsport, I think, at first, right around in mid-1850s. This town has been here. There was a battle of the Revolutionary War. They recently found, somebody just redid their basement in our town, and they found the skeletons of British soldiers who were killed in the Revolutionary War buried beneath their basement.
Wow.
And the town was founded in the 1600s. So, and it's very, very hilly, and it's where there used to be farms. And once they got out to the Midwest and they realized how much better it is to farm on flat land with good soil, they just abandoned these farms. So it's all the forests grew back, but in them are all these structures of old, faded, fallen down stone houses. Ugh. And what amazed me when we first got here is there's in our town, there's a mountain that's the highest point between the Berkshire Mountains and the Long Island Sound. And you go to the top of that mountain and you can see the Long Island Sound and across it to Long Island. And it's just trees. I mean, you'd never know that there's a town anywhere in there. It just looks like the forest. But of course, beneath that is all these towns, and it's just very different than the Midwest, where you could see everything's revealed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And here it's like everything's hidden.
One of the other things that intrigued you is the more you got into this, the research for this piece, you and Jennifer might have run in the very same circles. You might have known each other, right?
Right. Well, yeah, she was from Brooklyn. She went to a kind of a really nice private school in Brooklyn, where I know people that went. She went to Brown. She graduated the same year I graduated from Tulane, and she was in these kind of different circles. And one was, she was friends with these people around this magazine called Open City, and was very close to and lived with the guy who started that magazine. He's a very good friend of mine. I was at those parties.
Yeah, that's so...
You know, and she must have been at the parties. And then her writing teacher at NYU, she was a playwright, was a guy that I was in a writer's room with on a TV show a few years ago. And, like, there's so many different points of connection.
I know. That's so spooky. Rich, we got to take a short break. I'm talking to Rich Cohn about his story, my story, featured in the Chicago Tribune today, and his six-part series featured in Airmail. We'll talk a little bit more about Airmail. And you have told me this is the hardest, among the hardest stories you've ever worked on, and you've worked on some very, very hard ones, including Jerry Weintraub's autobiography. We'll be right back. There is a fascinating, substantive, and remarkable new publication online. It is online. It is Airmail. Airmail.news, and that is where Rich Cohn published his recent six-part series about murder in Fairfield County, a remarkable and tragic story of an ill-fated woman. It all started, you know, from all outward appearances, these two seemed to be in love for a time, and then it all went to hell. And the other thing, in the final section of the thing, you write, when if Jennifer had a weakness, it was her taste in men. In her mid-20s, according to several friends, she had flings with future at-me-too ne'er-do-wells Charlie Rose and Matt Lauer. To your credit, you follow up and try to get both of them to say something about that whole thing. Rich, was this emotionally tough for you? I know it, as a narrative, you wanted to keep readers kind of on the edge of their chair or couch, but for you, was it emotionally draining?
Well, it was a big puzzle. Like, you know, it was emotionally draining in that it's so the material is so intense and it was hard to deal with, and it was also like the puzzle of it is what is motivating this man who was her husband, who was 2 years ahead of her in Brown at Brown University. His name was Fotis Doulos. They'd gone to college together, then met again about 10 years after college. And it's almost like trying to understand evil.
Yeah.
You know, because there's a big blank in the story, which is, you know, everyone said to me, well, you know, why weren't she better protected? Why didn't people see this? Because there's a lot of bad marriages, but they don't. This doesn't happen.
Exactly.
I mean, there's no way
right.
to imagine this happening and then to work backwards from it. And for me, too, it was just, it's like hard to believe it actually happened because it's hard to understand why anybody would do what he did and act the way that he did. And that was something, and I just, in the pieces, I just kept presenting the questions because I don't know the answers.
Right.
You know,
right.
I don't know why, I don't know if he was a psychopath, if he was crazy, if in his head somehow he justified what he did, if he, or if he, you know, to some extent was able to sort of tell himself, which is all I could think of, I didn't do it, even after he did it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a schizophrenia. I just couldn't, you know, wrap my head around it, or if he had a complete breakdown in his personality and his business was in trouble and his marriage was in trouble. And then it was just very hard to do just because I had to be writing a story a week.
Oh, and you were.
And, which meant I had to, yeah, to be like researching and writing a story 1 week while editing and fact checking the previous story at the same time. So I hadn't really foreseen that. So the weird thing was that period when I did that for 6 weeks, it was like I disappeared from the face of the earth and I went into this kind of trance. And then I came out of it. Now we're in this.
Now we're in another trance. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very strange. Yeah.
What's the response, I have to believe, not just from Rick Kogan in the Tribune, but from all manner of readers, has to be, because there was a lot of stuff on Facebook about this, and you know, people were commenting all throughout the case. It must have been gratifying to you, yeah?
Yes. I mean, the response was massive and it was intense and it was gratifying. And it seems like everybody around here I know has read it and has their opinions on it. It was also a weird thing because normally you write a piece, you finish a piece, and then you separate from the piece. That's how I feel.
Yeah.
And then when it comes out, and even if it's being criticized, it's like, that's not me anymore. You
right,
know?
Exactly.
There's a line in a Leonard Cohen song I always think of when I got a bad review, which says, you can stick your pins in that voodoo doll, but that's not me, you know?
Right.
It doesn't look like me at all. So
right.
That's how I always felt about it. But with this, it was me because I was right in the middle of it. And then the reporting changed because what happened is as the pieces started to come out, old friends of Jennifer's and some old friends of Fotis's started to contact me
yep.
with more information, and people started to tell me their opinions and what they thought. So it kind of had this feeling of writing in the middle of a crowd or writing on stage.
Writing
you know?
On stage is how you put it to me, and I think that's exactly,
yeah.
exactly.
It was like performance art. I've never really done anything like it.
Yeah. There must be... For 1 second, talk to me. Airmail, you had a relationship with Airmail that was started by Graydon Carter, the former editor of Vanity Fair, longtime editor of Vanity Fair. And he gave you this space. And I think in these, you know, Twitter short attention span literary times, I think that was crucial. I don't think this could have been done any other way.
Yeah. Well, I said that basically. Once I started to get into it, The first is it will just write like a regular story. That's like 2,000, 3,000
uh-huh.
word story. And I'm like, not only is this, I guess it can be done, but I don't want to do it.
Yep.
I don't want to write this short.
Yep.
And I don't want to write it all in one piece. I want it to be this kind of story that unfolds. And it seems to me when you have so much trouble sort of holding people's attention, a good way to do it is instead of one really long piece or one really short piece, several short pieces that are one story that unfold, and you give people a week to think about it between pieces.
Mm.
And I said to somebody, thank God people, it connected and people liked it, because it would have been really hard to continue on if I felt like nobody was reading it. You know what I mean?
Well,
like,
yeah, but you write with such a strong narrative drive that I can't imagine anybody not doing it. And you did it here, too, even though at one point you probably didn't know quite where everything was going early on in this thing. But it's a real credit to you, Bell. I can't tell you. Your latest book, The Last Pirate of New York, A Ghost, you're prolific. A Ghost Shop, A Killer, and The Birth of the Gangster Nation is coming out in paperback soon, is it not?
Yeah, it's coming out in paperback in June.
See, I think one way to ease the pains that we're suffering now is to read. Rich has a number of books. He's got Tough Jews, Father's Sons, and Gangster Dreams. When I stop talking, you'll know I'm dead, written the autobiography of the one and only Jerry Weintraub. Then Monsters, the 1985 Chicago Bears and Wild Heart of Football, and the Chicago Cubs, Story of a Curse, and then a book about the Rolling Stones, and then a book about Record Men. You're taking it easy now, playing with the kids now, probably, are you?
Yeah. But it's interesting that you said that about reading. I find that really now, that's when reading is so important, because then you realize, as bad as things are, this is not the first time people have gone through things like this before. They survived. You're not alone. It gives you some sense of perspective and some sense of, you know, that there will be an end to this and life will go on. And you know, it's sort of like you try to get stronger from it and not let it completely knock you down.
Yeah. Are the kids...
And that's books.
Are the kids scared? Age
16? No, man. That's the great thing about being a kid. I mean, I guess if somebody got sick or it was closer to them. But, you know, I look at our four-year-old and I feel so much energy for him because he's got no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
Him and my dog, Muddy, have no idea what's going on.
Go to authorrichcohen.com or to airmail.news. You'll be mightily rewarded. You can read my story in the Sunday art section today, and you have time to read. You have time to read. Rich, it's always great to talk to you. It's even better to always read you. I can't wait to read what's next.
Thanks so much for the support, Rick. I really appreciate it. Take care of yourself.
Love to the family. You too. You too. That is a really good guy. And it's an amazing story told about as well as you could possibly imagine that story to be told. In the next half hour, I'm trying to keep you on the air. You can watch CNN if you like, but I've heard all the news I can take for one day. We're going to have Michael and Jeffrey Gentile talking about their book, Mob Adjacent, A Family Memoir, which is going to be republished by Eckhart's Press. And so we'll have Rick Camper on from Eckhart's Press, too. And then at 10 o'clock, the one and only Tony Fitzpatrick, artist, philosopher. I want him to explore how he is coping with our unfortunate situation and how he thinks it might change the future, I think, for the better. And then at 10:30, the premiere of a new Steve Goodman CD. So, 9:30, we'll be back. Welcome back. Some years ago, not that long ago, in April of 2018, I ran into a couple of fascinating guys, Michael Jr. and Jeffrey Gentile, and they told me a story, which is included in their book. He said, we were taking coats from the people who came over to visit our parents, and this gun just dropped on the floor, said Michael. For us, it wasn't a matter of, oh, my God, look, a gun, but, hey, we better figure out which coat this fell out of and put it back. These two brothers, separated by 14 months, have written a fascinating book titled Mob Adjacent, A Family Memoir. Michael and Jeffrey, how are you?
I'm fine, Rick. How are you today, buddy?
I'm good. You know, it's a tough time out here. Tough time out here.
It is indeed.
You wanted to read something, Michael.
I really would. This is something that Jeff and I feel real strongly about. Before we start tooting our horn, I think it's necessary for us to purvey this.
Sure.
Okay. We are all living through an extraordinary moment in time. Our first reaction here at Mob Adjacent to the coronavirus was to put a contract out on it. Since that's not possible, what we can do is start the Lunch Forward program. Mob Adjacent and our new publisher, Eckerd Press, will each be donating $500 to the Greater Chicago Food Depository. Heading up the program is our cousin, Liz Gentile. She's the director of purchasing at the Greater Chicago Food Depository. Just like Big Al Capone did during the Depression, by opening up soup kitchens for hungry men, this time it's our precious children in need. And at this time, us at Mob Adjacent and Eckerd Press will be providing food and funds for those less fortunate. And through my vast connections in the food service industry, I have brought aboard two giants, Peter Testa from Testa Produce in Chicago and Jack Marchese from V. Marchese in Milwaukee. Both have agreed to donate products intended to go to schools before the onslaught of this horrible virus. Last but not least, we will be selling our book for $20 with a free hat or T-shirt, with $10 of the proceeds going directly to the Greater Chicago Food Depository. Since we all must be practicing social distancing, this will allow us something interesting to read. Thank you for your time from Mob Adjacent and Eckerd Press, and please, be safe. Thank you for your time.
That's really a wonderful, wonderful thing to do. I'm assuming that idea just popped up in the last week or so, right?
Well, you know, when they started to tell us to stay home, and yeah. I read in the newspaper the other day that the food banks were running out of food to feed these kids who weren't getting their lunch at school, and it hit me that we here are far more fortunate. Thank you so much. And I think it's best that we pass it on, and the connections that I have to provide food are seem to be endless. So with the proper promotion, I think we can really generate a lot of revenues for this food bank and feed these kids while this mess is going on.
Yeah, I admire you tremendously for that.
Well, Rick, we thank you for giving us a forum to push this out there, because without you...
I found you guys when you sent me that book, and I kind of went crazy about it. I said, this is a fascinating book about the two of you growing up in something like, just like episodes of The Wonder Years, until they started getting interrupted by episodes of The Sopranos. Tell me about how you guys decided, remind me, to write a book.
You know, originally, Jeff used... Go ahead, Jeff.
Originally, Mike wanted to make some videos so that his children and grandchildren would know these stories.
Right.
And once he and I started working on that, I said, well, we really need to write a book about this. And then over the next 9 to 10 months, we collaborated long distance, me in Pasadena, California, mm-hmm. and Mike at his home in Lyle, and produced this book, you know, stirring up all these memories that have been percolating in our minds and in our backgrounds our whole lives.
What do you think? The book, when I wrote about it, the book kind of took off from there, in a sense, because the mob still has this unbelievable pull on the local Chicago lives. You were interviewed by Ro Khan. You were interviewed by John Cass, by Steve Dahl, John Howell, Larry Potash. You self-published the book. Why was that? I ever thought that it was could find a mainstream publisher. What happened there?
It's a wicked
business.
And publishers, and it was met with absolute disinterest.
Why?
So we just... I can't explain that to you, Rick.
Yeah.
But we decided since the technology exists, we self-published and we self-promoted shamelessly.
Yes, you did. But you're good at it. You're good at it.
Hey, listen, I found those boys from Eckerd Press, and if Rick is listening, he told me initially that we've already done what he does.
Uh-huh.
And then I said to him, if you published a book and it blew up, what would you do? And he said, well, you know, I'm going to have to talk to David Stern, my partner.
Yeah.
And they met me at a Starbucks at Harlem and Lawrence,
uh-huh.
and we banged out a deal. I walked out above the ground, Rick. Jeff always said what we needed was a publisher.
Yep.
And somehow with me self-promoting my buns off, I found the boys from Eckerd.
Well, they are good boys. We're going to have Rick on, I think, in about 10 minutes to tell us from his point of view what so appealed to him. Jeff and Mike, what do you think is the appeal? It's simply not, hey, mobsters. It's got to be more than that because you are.
We feel it's familial, Rick. I mean, you know,
right.
I think every Italian. You know, we're gonna do a little something when this mess clears up, and we're gonna ask America to send us your mob adjacent experiences. And my bet is everyone has one, Ricky. Everyone has an Uncle Vito, or their neighbor had an Uncle John who used to come over with a Cadillac and a pinky ring, and he was, you know, you throw those air quotes up and say, connected, you know?
Right.
And we were fortunate growing up, and I say fortunate because we only saw the good sides of those people. Of course,
sure.
We know what they did for work, but like Jeff said before, they didn't do it at our house.
Right.
They were loving uncles who brought those. You know, you wanted those guys to come to your birthday party when you were 10 because grandma gave you 5 and those guys gave you 20.
Uh-huh.
You know, when you got married, you know, Uncle Joe gave you 100, but Uncle Jimmy, he gave you 500. You know, it was just
dead
envelopes and the respect that Jeff and I had for those guys prior to us knowing what they were.
Now, did you guys rework the book for this new Eckerd Press publication?
Well, we're actually going to do that. I'm writing some additional chapters, some of which
we'll talk
about what's happened since the book was published, because there was a lot since you gave us our first big break on your radio show,
uh-huh.
and then again in your Tribune column. So, yeah, I'm writing new chapters, and we reached out to some of our mob adjacent and mob connected friends for more candid mob photos. So yeah, we're expecting an expanded edition.
Well, you got, you know, there are people in the book like Bill Hannard, Murray Humphreys. They're just any number of mob and semi mob names that would echo through anybody. Jack Humphreys. You expect this to be a movie, do you not?
Well, we hope that we're now negotiating for a documentary on a famous jewel heist that everybody knows about.
Uh-huh.
You know, with the times being the way they are and the genre being hot again, if you will,
The
Irishman, and we feel that we've got something to say that nobody else can say. We got 80-year-old guys who want to tell us stories where nobody was injured or nobody was killed, but people want to know about Bill Hannard. We could tell him about guys who were on one or two of his crews.
Sure.
Nobody could do that.
Sure. Now, how do you do most of the writing, Jeffrey? You do most of the writing out in L.A.?
I do most of it here.
Okay.
Yeah, but, you know, Mike and I are on the phone sometimes 9-10 times a day.
Wow.
You know, I got to check something or he remembers something, and we just start knocking ideas around.
Hmm. Let's try to get Rick Kampfer on the phone, because I want to hear what it was that appealed to him about this book. You're having a good relationship with him, are you not?
Oh, I tell you what, for a brand new friend, he's been terrific.
Yeah.
And him and his partner, David, I mean,
David's great.
They've given us nothing but time, and we appreciate what they can do for us, and we appreciate what we could do for them. So I think it's a perfect relationship.
Yeah, yeah. We'll see. Well, let's take a break, and we'll get see if Dan can get him on the phone, and then we'll come back. I'm happy for you guys. I knew that this this project was going to have legs. I still love that thing, my lead of the story. Childhood is or should be a time of innocence, and for a while, that is the way it was for brothers Michael and Jeffrey Gentile. And then a pistol fell out of a coat. We'll be back in a couple minutes, joined by Rick Camphor, I think.
Have you ever...
Welcome back. Rick Camphor is, can't get him, but we're running on a kind of, you know, not full steam here. So what I want to talk to you two boys about, Michael Gentile and Jeffrey Gentile, is I know you guys can come on strong. I want to know exactly how you made your pitch to Rick and his partner, David.
Well, I went in with, they sent them the book. Jeff had sent them two chapters first to kind of trap them. And then I sent them the book. And both of them read the book. And both of them were totally impressed with Jeff's ability as a writer.
Yeah.
And the story itself, because it was so true to life and familial, wasn't your every run-of-the-mill book about the outfit. You know, we're not trying to really make any money off it. We're not ratting anybody out. We don't have an axe to grind.
No.
All we're doing is telling our story of our lives.
What have you heard, after the book was published, what kind of things did you hear from not only your friends, but from people in the business, your business especially?
People in the business, because I went for a blessing prior to us even starting it. And they're 83 or 84-year-old guys who, you know, are a half a decade younger than my dad. But because of my dad's elevation to the person who fixed places for those guys, everybody knew my dad. And because everybody knew my dad, Jeff and I got deference to kind of do what we wanted as long as we were going to do it respectfully. And as you see, we were very respectful. And when it came out, and when a couple of them actually read it, they were very impressed again with Jeff's ability to tell the story. We were able to meet with Bill Hanhart, Rick. I sat with him and had lunch with him 2.5 weeks before he died. He told us stories. Two of the guys who were in Bill's crew are waiting for us to get these deals so we can tell their stories. And all they are is heist stories and stories about stuff where people didn't get hurt. Victimless crimes, if you will. But crimes nonetheless.
my favorite story was when one of the Grand Avenue, one of the guys from down on Grand Avenue was asking around, who are these guys who are making money off our street?
Right.
You know, as if we owed them a street tax. And one of our supporters quickly put a protective arm around us and said, we're with them, and we were good again.
Wow, wow.
You know, see, they seen us with a camera crew, Ricky, in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And I guess we were supposed to go ahead and ask if it was okay.
Uh-huh.
So I get the word down at the market at work that one of the guys over there on Grand Avenue was interested in seeing me, and I had never met him. I heard of him. So right away I called to our protective arm, and I said, listen, not for nothing, but if I was a little disrespectful or I did something I wasn't supposed to do, a million sorries. He goes, what are you talking about? I said, I was just whistled in to go to Grand Avenue and go talk to this guy because he wants to know I got a lot of nerve. He says, you don't go nowhere. 2 days later, the guy called and apologized to me.
Wow. Wow.
He said, listen, Mike, I didn't know you were with those guys. And listen, you tell your story any way you want.
All right, here, we have Rick on the phone. Rick.
Oh, there you go.
Hey, Rick,
hey,
I want
how
you
are
to
you?
I'm good. How are you? I want you to explain to me how you were seduced by these two fine gentlemen, Jeff and Mike.
Well, I think probably the same way you were seduced, Rick.
Yeah, I know.
They're like forces of nature, these guys.
Yes,
their personalities are amazing. And, you know, he actually, Mike told me that he knew you and that you wrote about him. And he said, check with Rick. Ask Rick. So I emailed you, didn't I?
Yeah, I'm sure.
And you said, yeah, these guys are the real deal. And that's when I decided to have my meeting with them. And my partner Dave and I did. And Mike, you know, convinced me after like 30 seconds of talking to him. And I had read two chapters of the book that Jeff had sent me. And like you, like the gun fell out, you know?
I mean, wait,
that's just an ordinary story. The first 120 pages take place in the 50s and 60s, and it's like watching, you know, The Sopranos in their heyday. It was really an amazing story.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I know that because of the current troubles, Eckhart's Press, you're also publishing the great Roger Badish autobiography. Have things been put off or put on hold because of all this?
Well, we got a notice on Friday, I guess it was, that our printer is not considered
an essential.
Yes. So I think, unfortunately for Roger, we were right about to go to press.
Oh, I know. He was so excited, and as justifiably so, because I've read that book, too. So I guess it's impossible, all three of you gentlemen, Rick Kampfer, Mike, and Jeff Gentile, to anticipate when this book might be published, isn't it?
Yeah, I think everything's kind of up in the air, but I know that we're going to be working together because... you know, we hit it off in the first project you mentioned earlier. We're going to be helping out the food pantries.
That's fellas, that's really, really a great thing.
Do what we can while we can.
Yeah.
Absolutely. If we're able to help those who are less than able, believe me when I tell you, self-reward is behind me, and all we want to do is pay it forward because we're very fortunate.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe one day this will be a... You know, you can go to Eckhart's Press, EckhartsPress.com. They have a number of fine, fine books that, and I am a huge believer in, while we're all trying to escape and maybe taking a walk by yourself, but also sitting in bed and reading is a wonderful, wonderful escape. Ricky, how many books have you published now?
I think we have done 60 books now.
Wow.
Nice. Wow. That's great.
Congratulations. That's really something. And this, of course.
And all Chicago books, too.
Yeah, I know.
All about Chicago or, you know, Chicago-related type books.
And the Gentile brothers, obviously, will be the best-selling books in the history of Eckhart's Press.
Well, this one certainly qualifies as a Chicago story, doesn't it?
Yes. It certainly does.
We are homespun, I think that's for sure.
That's for sure. And you will be great at promoting your book. That's another thing, Rick, that you must have sensed about.
Well, I mean, listen, this team here, you've got the one brother who's a great writer, the other brother's a great promoter.
Yep.
I mean, you couldn't draw it up any better than that.
Yeah, no kidding. No.
And then we got you guys to point us in the right direction. I'm talking about both Ricks on the other end. I mean, our level of support for local media, you can't believe how grateful we are for all the kudos that we've achieved so far. And with this food bank thing, which I'm putting in front of everything else that we have, I think it's one of the most...
Yeah, talk about that. Do that again before I let you go. Talk about what you're doing with that food bank thing, Mike.
Well, what we're doing is we're getting people who are now stuck with product, Rick, because they're out of business. They can't deliver to the schools.
Right.
So they've got this product in their warehouses, and they're looking for a place to go with it, you know, because it's not an item that... like we can sell. It's all food service items.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a retail item.
Right.
So I'm able to tap into these guys and for a good cause. I mean, they're all for it. Peter Testa from Testa Produce is he donates stuff regularly anyway to the Chicago Food Bank. And when I called him today, he was 100% behind. I told him I was going to use his name and his company's name. And he said it wasn't necessary, but thank you. And the same thing with Jack Marchese. These guys are big providers to the public school systems for product. And when they closed the schools, you know, abruptly like that, they hit warehouses full of stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's just a great thing all of you guys are doing. It's great to talk to you, Rick Camper, and it's always a pleasure to talk to the Gentile brothers, the famous authors. I'll let you know when the book is out. It's not going to be in the next couple of weeks, but it is. We can all hope. We can all hope.
Keep up the good work, Rick, and say hello to my good buddy, Tony Fitzpatrick, who's coming up.
I will indeed. I will indeed. And your good other stable member, Roger Badish. All of you, take care of yourselves, please.
Rick, thank you again so much.
Thank you. Anytime. Anytime. Those are interesting guys. Let me read something else from this. They were all friends. Joey the Clown Lombardo, Frank Skip Cerrone, his brother Jimmy Cerrone. The brother's grandfather came here when he was 2 years old, 2 years old from Italy, settled with his parents and grand in Aberdeen. It's a fascinating book, and I hope it does well. Coming up momentarily in a few minutes after the news, I'll talk to Tony Fitzpatrick about. Tony is an artist. You may know him. He's an artist. He's a raconteur. He is a actor. He is a bon vivant. He's a good guy, and he is a good thinker. And I want to find out what he's doing with his time. Because he's locked up. He can make art, unlike many of us who can consume art. Tony can make art. And I think he's going out to take solitary walks, too, to see what that's like, too. So we'll talk to him after the top of the hour. Welcome back. One of the most interesting people I have ever met in my long, checkered career is my friend Tony Fitzpatrick. He is an artist. He is an actor. He is a raconteur. He is a playwright. He is many, 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 many things, and he is a dear friend of mine. I was reading Tony a few things that he'd written on Facebook, and one of the, you know, there's a lot of drivel on Facebook because this is where some people decide, I can't express myself anywhere, so I'll just write some junk on Facebook. Tony, your stuff has really moved me. It's a wonderful way to express yourself. Do you feel that way?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I've always thought, you know, at its best, Facebook connects us in a way that, particularly visual artists, you know, yeah. I mean, I've gotten to know so many of my friends in other countries, in other nations, around the world, because of Facebook. I mean, it's brought us all together and allowed us to have a conversation free of the gatekeepers, you know, the dealers and the curators, and, you know, where we could just kind of talk to each other. And, you know, I mean, I met my friend, the great Gary Taxali, from Toronto, you know, who's one of the world's finest illustrators and artists. And, you know, I got to know him through Facebook, and when I was in Paris filming, he was having a show there. We got to meet, and what was odd was that we'd known each other for 7 years, but we realized the night we shook hands that we'd never met face to face before.
But you'd known each other via Facebook, right?
Yeah. I mean, and I'd always admired his work. I mean, just absolutely adore it, and that goes for you know, hundreds of other artists, you know, Lou Beach, Heather Horton, Hudson Marquez, the guys from Ant Farm, Bale Creek Allen. It's amazing. George Handeen. I could name them all night,
Well, let's name John Sauce.
Hey, what?
We'll name John Sauce, too.
Absolutely, the great John Sauce. I mean, that's where I found that work and realized he was decoding Lake Michigan and had this dialogue going on with the natural world that, quite honestly, I was envious of.
Yeah, I know. You told me.
And and it was a revelation. He had his first exhibition with us this year, and it was a knockout success. And you know, again, I mean, Facebook can be a very good thing. It can be a very stupid thing, and I've indulged in a little of that, too.
I think we may be reaching some kind of interesting point with Facebook, because if you're a little discriminating about it and pick and choose what you can tell pretty fast, don't you think, Tony? If someone has posted something, whether it's some self-serving junk or some, neo-Nazi.
The morons weed themselves out, I like to say.
Yeah.
But I found some really thoughtful stuff. There's a wonderful personality, a guy named Stephen Elcock, who's got a book out, and he's always posting things that are marvelous visually and intellectually, and I've learned a lot from looking at them, and I friended him, and again, I don't know him, but I love what he posts. I love what the artist Nicholas Sisler posts. He always finds interesting stuff to look at and to think about. There's just a lot of very thoughtful stuff there if you're discerning and if you look for it.
Well, one of the things about you, my friend, is your art is so provocative and so detail-oriented and so it begs a person to dive into the artwork. Am I making too much of that? I really have ever felt that way.
I've enjoyed the incredible feedback I've gotten from Facebook. I mean, from people who like looking at the work, and I found it a great place to test out, not only the artwork, but new writing and stuff like that. And I go off politically all the time too, because I just can't help it lately.
Well, of course.
I honestly think that as far as going to return to sanity,
yeah,
and we're going to ask ourselves,
what have we done?
What were we thinking? Honestly, this particularly, I've started keeping a diary since the lockdown started,
right?
And I will say this, I think we've gotten exemplary and extraordinary leadership from Governor Pritzker and from Mayor Lightfoot.
No question. No, JB.
And I think, we dodged such a bullet. If this were just one scant year ago and it were Rahm and Rauner, where do you think we would be with this?
I hesitate to think.
It's frightening to think of it.
Yeah.
But I think they have both served our city and our state very, very well.
How are you dealing?
The lockdown, it's a little hard to swallow. We've closed up the galleries and, realized a couple of days into it, we might never reopen. We don't know.
But you're also getting out in the and I do believe.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I do believe in this.
I quit my health club because just expenses and I work for myself. My wife works for herself.
Yeah.
There are a lot of
creeps who go to your health club.
We tighten our belts and.
Besides,
I was getting into all kinds of arguments because I was wearing my Bernie shirt around East Bank. You want to start some conversation? That's a good place to start.
Yeah.
So after I threatened the life of the third guy, I thought, maybe I should get out of here. And I started walking around Humboldt Park, and what a joy that is.
I think one of the things that people are beginning to realize is in this city that is now gone mostly silent, that in which one can still, without a big group around, explore the city. You are a huge bird person, and you must hear.
Absolutely. This city has a great deal to offer in the way of the natural world. I mean, I walked along the lakefront this afternoon with my friend Chris Keogh and his dog. I'm making it a point to get a mile and a half worth of steps in every day because I'm a heart patient.
Yeah, good for you.
And yeah, and tomorrow I have to have dental surgery, of all things. And I make it a point to get my exercise.
Yeah,
and
as well you
I'm
should.
I'm going to miss the pool. I mean, I will say this. East Bank has the greatest pool in the world and inhabited by some of the kindest and most lovely people, you know.
Yeah.
But you know what? I started walking around the bird sanctuary part of Humboldt Park because it's right by my house.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm three blocks east of it. And I started keeping this diary, and today I wrote an entry, and I'd love to share it with you. So.
Let's take a commercial break, and I would love to hear it, Tony. Thanks. We'll be back in 2 minutes. It is with extreme pleasure that I introduce Tony Fitzpatrick. Reading. What is it you're going to read, Tony?
This is my coronavirus diary, day 7. Walking through Humboldt Park on Wednesday, I sat down on a bench after a loop around the boathouse and the bird sanctuary part of the park. I'd been trying to keep from freaking out about the enormous changes in our world manifested in the last week. I quit my health club because of expenses and shuttered both of the galleries. As I sat there, I realized that they might never reopen, that walking in this park would be the new normal. And this was more than okay. For the first time since this whole mess started, I was somewhere quiet. I wasn't hearing about the pandemic. The coronavirus babbled in my ear from every news source constantly. There was green, trees, grasses, marsh weeds, and the water. It was solitude, it was stillness, and I needed to drink that in. I needed to think, and this was the place to do it. I looked at the water and I saw Canadian geese, mallards, and wood ducks. And around me in the park, I'd noticed robins, red-winged blackbirds, and grackles, as well as copious gulls. This place was perfect for all I had to think about, which was how to remain calm, how to accept that which I could not change, how to go forward with the sometimes arduous business of living one day at a time, one foot in front of the other, and being grateful for it. I grew up watching monster movies as a kid, Giant Gila Monster, Creature from the Black Lagoon, Frankenstein, Willard. Spoiler alert, a bunch of rats eat Ernest Borgnine. The Abominable Dr. Fives, you name it, I saw every gruesome mutation the movie record could concoct in the relatively naive age of 1960s America. Oh, there were plenty of societal horrors, wars, assassinations, but those were too real. Those were things we heard on the news. Those were somebody else's monsters. Mine were out of the comics. Creepy, eerie, and the pulp novels. The one that scared the hell out of me was I Am Legion by Richard Matheson. It became an equally scary movie with Charlton Heston and Anthony Zerba. Heston plays the last man alive, or so he thinks, and he is holed up in a building in what I think is either downtown L.A. or San Francisco. I'm not sure which. And he is surrounded by an army of zombie-like mutants who can only come out at night. Led by the amazing Zerba, who is an underrated character actor his whole life. He plays a former news anchor gone mad after becoming a mutant from an unnamed plague. That was the truly frightening part. The unnamed plague. The one that wiped most of humanity out and made the rest into mindless, fanatical zombies who practice some inane religion, led by a psychologically stunted and leering madman. Actually, a good deal like Trump and his voters. I would say that, but Zerbes Mathias is infinitely smarter and more likable than Trump, which is to say, not at all. But the real monster is the plague itself. Heston survived it because he is injured while bringing the vaccine back to America. He injects himself and he is cured. This, by the way, in no way portends a happy ending. I could not stop thinking of this movie while walking an empty park yesterday. While able to hear every sound of every bird in that park, it centered me. I sat down and I was able to cobble together something like a plan B. I was also able to accept that life was changing in a tidal way, that nothing that comes after this, if I live through it, will be the same. I'm 61 years old. I've lived longer than anyone thought I would. I've been lucky in my life. My wife, my kids, my friends, my work. I got no complaints. While this thing descends upon us, I decided I'm going to try to be the best version of human that I can be. I make sense out of the world by making pictures about it. One of the devices I relied on as a kid was drawing giant creatures taking revenge on us, locusts, eagles, cicadas, and wolves, all of them opening up a giant can of whoop-ass on whichever segment of humanity I thought needed a good ass-kicking that day. Mostly it was nuns and Christian brothers who took turns playing tetherball with my head as a kid. Hell, I learned how to throw a left hook from a nun. She would pretend she was going to smack me with her right hand, and then, boom, she would hammer me with her left. I made a note to myself, in the unlikely case of a rematch, hit the nun first. These drawings were great fun. They allowed me to get a little karmic revenge on the nuns, teachers, and cops, and anyone else I thought a pain in the ass who had a minor own business. This drawing that I made today is a bit like that. It's a gigantic locust looming over Logan Square. And it's my way of saying, to hell with you, monster, I'm not afraid of you. The only thing I know about the coming days is that we have the best weapon known to mankind. We have each other.
Wow, Tony, that is incredibly, incredibly powerful. You should, if Tony's going to be doing this on a regular basis, go to his, find him on Facebook and read.
Yeah, I'm gonna,
what he has to say.
Keep a diary. I mean,
and the other great thing about it is our mutual friend Studs Terkel once titled one of his books, "Hope Dies Last." And I
absolutely.
And you and I
have
pal,
it tattooed to my forearm.
I know
you got it the day that Studs died.
I know you do. I know you do. What do they have to do at the dentist with you tomorrow?
Oh, they got to remove three teeth that are being a pain in the ass.
Okay. And, well, the old days, someone would have just knocked them out for you.
You know what? Amen. Believe me, plenty of guys tried.
Yeah, I know, man. I know. Michelle is well, your wife?
Michelle is well. I'm sitting here across from Gabby.
Give them all my love.
You know, we're writing, we're drawing, we're scheming, we're planning.
Yeah.
I mean, the one thing I keep noticing is that on social media, everybody is working on jigsaw puzzles.
Not me.
You know,
yeah.
You know what? Me neither. Because, Rick, you know what? Two things I'm not proud of. I've never finished a jigsaw puzzle.
Same here.
And I've never finished a New York Times crossword puzzle. Some people got the mind for that.
Yeah.
I'm not one of them. But what I can do is make a beautiful drawing that can make a cool jigsaw puzzle.
Tony,
so,
Tony, get in and out of the dentist quickly, and we'll talk soon, and we'll see where this whole adventure is leading
absolutely.
Us.
Absolutely. Hey, love to you.
Love
and
to
Fiona
you, too.
And Kathy
you
and everybody.
Bet. You bet, honey. Take care.
All right, brother.
Okay.
Talk to you.
You too. He's really something. That was a very, very powerful, powerful song. You are going to hear, just because I'm sort of sick of hearing myself talk, frankly, we're going to rewind to 1969 when the city of New Orleans was just a train waiting for an anthem. 69 when Steve Goodman was just a young, up-and-coming singer. This is a wonderful, wonderful CD that I'm going to play excerpts from after 10 o'clock, and then 30. And God, he looks so young. It's released by Omnivore Records. I'll write about it, and you can see all the information I have about it. It's not being released till October 3rd, but you're going to hear some vintage, and I mean vintage, Steve Goodman after this.